Chapter 52. The Ocean Retriever, with Pitt, Giordino, Gunn, and Julia on board, was the first to arrive and position herself over the wreck of the Princess Doan. The Canadian salvage ship from Deep Abyss Systems Limited out of Montreal, Hudson Bay, arrived only 4 hours later. She was an older vessel converted from a powerful ocean-going salvage and tugboat. Aided by clear weather and smooth water, the salvage of the art treasures commenced immediately. The underwater part of the project was handled by submersibles using articulated arms in cooperation with divers encased in deep-water atmospheric diving systems called Newt suits that were similar in appearance to the Michelin Tire Man. Bulbous, constructed of fiberglass and magnesium and self-propelled, the suit enabled a diver inside to work for long periods of time at the 400-foot-plus depth without concern over decompression. The artifacts were beginning to come up systematically and with rapid regularity once a routine was established. The operation continued at an even more rapid pace when the U.S. Navy salvage vessel Dean Hawes came charging down from the north end of the lake 2 days earlier than expected, and took up station beside the other two ships. She was considered new, only 2 years from her launch date, and was constructed especially for deep water work, the recovery of submarines in particular. An immense open barge with long ballast tanks attached along its hull was parked in place by use of the global positioning system and sunk, falling to the lake bed a short distance from the forward section of the Princess Doan. Then crane operators, working from the ships on the surface and employing underwater cameras, manipulated the clamshell claws on the end of their winch cables, deftly recovering the crates exposed on the outer decks of the ship, those deep inside the cargo holds, and the artifacts littering the bottom between the two sections of the broken hull. The crates, together with their contents, were then lifted onto the sunken barge. When it was fully loaded, the ballast tanks were filled with pressurized air, and the barge rose to the surface. A tugboat then took it in tow for the trip to the port of Chicago, where it was met by a team of Pneuma archaeologists who took charge of the art treasures. They very carefully removed them from the waterlogged packing cases and immediately immersed them in temporary conservation tanks, until they could be transported to a more permanent preservation facility. No sooner was one fully loaded barge towed off sight than another one was maneuvered into position and sunk, repeating the process. 6 submersibles, 3 owned by Pneuma, 1 by the Canadians, and 2 by the Navy, worked in harmony, meticulously lifting the crates with their invaluable contents into the specially designed cargo compartment of the sunken barge. To facilitate the removal of the artwork from inside the hull, the divers in the Newt suits cut through the steel plates with state-of-the-art torch systems that melted metal underwater at an incredible rate. Once an opening was made, the submersibles moved in and lifted out the treasures, aided by the clamshell claws from the cranes on the surface. The entire operation was observed and directed from a control room on board the Ocean Retriever. Video screens linked to cameras set at strategic locations around the wreck revealed every stage of the recovery project. The high-resolution video systems were carefully monitored by Pitt and Gunn, who managed the intricate deployment of men and equipment. They worked 12-hour shifts, as did the crews of all 3 vessels. The around-the-clock project never stopped bringing up the seemingly endless mountain of artifacts on the bottom below. Pitt would have given his right arm to have worked on the wreck in one of the submersibles or Newt suits, but, as project director, his experience was required to coordinate and guide the operation from the surface. He watched one of the monitors with envy as it showed Giordino being lifted into the Sappho 4 submersible, broken leg and all. Giordino had over 700 hours in submersibles, and the one he was piloting was his favorite. On this shift, the wily little Italian planned to take his sub deep into the Princess Doan's superstructure after the bulkheads were cut away by the divers inside the Newt suits. Pitt turned as Rudy Gunn stepped into the control room. The early sun flashed through the doorway, momentarily illuminating the compartment, which had no ports or windows. "You here already? I'd swear you just walked out." "It's that time," Gunn answered, smiling. He was carrying a large rolled mosaic photograph under one arm that had been shot above the wreck before the start of the salvage operation. The mosaic was invaluable in detecting artifacts that had been scattered in the debris field and for directing the submersibles and divers to different sections of the wreck. "How do we stand?" he asked. "The barge has been filled and is on its way to the surface," replied Pitt, his nose catching the smell of coffee from the galley and yearning for a cup. "I never cease to be amazed by the sheer numbers of it all," said Gunn, taking his place in front of the communications console and array of video screens. "The Princess Doan was incredibly overloaded," said Pitt. "It's no small wonder she broke up and sank in heavy weather." "How close are we to wrapping it up?" "Most all the loose packing crates have been recovered from the lake bed. The stern section is about cleaned out. The cargo holds should be emptied before the end of the next shift. Now it's down to ferreting out all the smaller cases that were stowed in the passageways and staterooms in the center part of the ship. The deeper they penetrate, the more difficult it is for the men in the Newt suits to cut through the bulkheads." "Any word on when Chin Chang's salvage ship is due to arrive?" Gunn asked. "The Jade Adventurer?" Pitt looked down on a chart of the Great Lakes spread out on a table. "At last report, she passed Quebec on her way down the St. Lawrence. Now that should put her here in a little under 3 days. She didn't waste any time coming off her search operation off Chile. She was on her way north less than an hour after Zhu Quan received your phony report from Perlmutter." "It's going to be close," said Gunn, as he watched a submersible's articulated fingers delicately pick up a porcelain vase protruding from the muck. "We'll be lucky to finish up and get out of the neighborhood before the Jade Adventurer and our friend come charging onto the scene." "We've been lucky Chin Chang didn't send any of his agents ahead to scout out the environment." "The Coast Guard cutter that patrols our search area has yet to report an encounter with a suspicious vessel. When I came on my shift last night, Al said a reporter from a local newspaper somehow got a call through to the ocean retriever. Al strung him along when the reporter asked what we were doing out here."
"What did Al tell him?"
"He said we were drilling cores in the bottom of the lake, looking for signs of dinosaurs."
"And the reporter bought it?" Gunn asked, skeptically.
"Probably not, but he got excited when Al promised to bring him on board over the weekend."
Gunn looked puzzled. "But we should be gone by then."
"You get the picture," Pitt laughed. "We should consider ourselves lucky that rumors of treasure haven't brought out swarms of salvers. They come as soon as they get the word and rush out to pick over the scraps." Julia came into the control room balancing a tray on one hand.
"Breakfast," she announced gaily. "Isn't it a beautiful morning?"
Pitt rubbed the stubble of a beard on his chin. "I hadn't noticed."
"What are you so happy about?" Gunn asked her.
"I just received a message from Peter Harper. Chin Chang came off a Japanese airliner at the Quebec airport disguised as a crew member. The Canadian Royal Mounted Police followed him to the waterfront, where he boarded a small boat and rendezvoused with the Jade Adventurer."
"Hallelujah!" exclaimed Gunn. "He took the bait."
"Hook, line, and sinker," said Julia, flashing her teeth.
She set the tray on the chart table and removed a tablecloth, revealing plates of eggs and bacon, toast, grapefruit, and coffee. "That is good news," said Pitt, pulling a chair up to the table without being told. "Did Harper say when he plans to take Chin Chang into custody?"
"He's meeting with the INS legal staff to formulate a plan. I must tell you, there is great fear the State Department and White House may intervene."
"I was afraid of that," said Gunn.
Peter and Commissioner Monroe are very afraid Chin Chang will slip through the net because of his political connections.
Why not board the Jade Adventurer and haul his ass off now? Gunn asked.
We can't legally apprehend him if his ship skirts the Canadian shoreline while sailing through Lakes Ontario, Erie, and Huron, explained Julia. Only after the Jade Adventurer has passed through the Straits of Mackinac into Lake Michigan will Chin Chang be on American waters.
Pitt slowly ate his grapefruit. I'd like to see his face when his crew lays a camera on the princess and finds her guts ripped out and her cupboards bare.
Did you know that he's filed a claim on the ship and its cargo through one of his subsidiary corporations in state and federal district courts?
No, said Pitt. But I'm not surprised. That's the way he operates.
Gunn wrapped a knife on the table.
If any of us were to stake a claim on a treasure ship through legal channels, we'd be laughed out onto the street. And whatever artifacts we found would have to be turned over to the government.
People who search for treasure, Pitt said philosophically, believe their problems are over when they make the big strike, never realizing their troubles are only beginning.
How true, Gunn assented.
I've yet to hear of a treasure discovery that wasn't contested in court by a parasite or government bureaucrat.
Julia shrugged.
Maybe so, but Chin Chang has too much influence to have the door slammed in his face. If anything, he's bought off all opposition.
Pitt looked at her as though his fatigued mind had suddenly thought of something.
Aren't you eating? He asked.
She shook her head.
I had a bite in the galley earlier.
The ship's first officer leaned in the doorway and motioned to Pitt.
The barge has surfaced, sir. You said you wanted to take a look at her payload before she was towed away.
Yes, thank you, Pitt acknowledged. He turned back to Gunn. She's all yours, Rudy. I'll see you, same time, same place tomorrow.
Gunn waved without taking his eyes from the monitors.
Sleep tight.
Julia hung on Pitt's arm as they stepped out onto the bridge wing and gazed down at the big barge that had risen from the depths. The interior cargo hold was filled with crates of all sizes containing incredible treasures from China's past. All had been neatly spaced by the cranes and submersibles. In a divided compartment with extra thick padding, the artworks, whose packing crates had been either damaged or destroyed, sat open and exposed. Some were musical instruments, tuned chimes of stone, bronze bells, and drums. There was a three-legged cooking stove with a hideous face molded on the door. Large jade ceremonial carvings of half-size men, women, and children, and animal sculptures in marble.
"Oh, look," she said, pointing. "They brought up the Emperor on the horse."
Standing under the sun for the first time in over half a century, the water glistening on the bronze armor of the rider and streaming from his horse, the 2,000-year-old sculpture looked little the worse for wear than the day it came out of the mold. The unknown emperor now stared over a limitless horizon, as if in search of new lands to conquer.
"It's all so incredibly beautiful," said Julia,
staring at the ancient wonder. Then she gestured at the other crates, their contents still hidden.
"I'm amazed the wooden containers did not rot away after being submerged all these years."
"General Hui was a thorough man," Pitt said.
Not only did he insist that the crates be built with an outer wall and an inner lining, he specified teak instead of a more common wood. It was probably transported to Shanghai from Burma by freighter for use in the shipyards. We knew that teak is extraordinarily strong and durable, and he undoubtedly seized the shipment to construct the crates. What he couldn't have predicted at the time was that his foresight paid off in protecting the treasures for the 50 years they were resting underwater.
Julia raised a hand to shield her eyes from the glare of the sun on the water.
"A pity he couldn't have made them watertight. The lacquerware, wooden carvings, and paintings cannot have survived without some damage or disintegration."
"The archaeologists will know soon enough. Hopefully the icy fresh water will have preserved many of the more delicate objects."
As the tugboat maneuvered into position to tow the barge to the receiving dock in Chicago,
A crewman stepped from the wheelhouse with a paper in his hand.
"Another message for you, Miss Lee, from Washington." "Must be another message from Peter," she said, taking the communication.
She studied the wording for a long time, her facial expression turning from surprise to utter frustration to downright anger.
"Oh, good God," she muttered.
"What is it?" Julia held out the message to Pitt.
"The INS operation to apprehend Chin Chang has been called off by order of the White House. We are not to molest or harass him in any way. Any and all treasure recovered from the Princess Doan is to be turned over to Chin Chang as acting representative of the Chinese government."
"That's crazy," Pitt said wearily, too tired to display outrage. "The man is a proven mass murderer. Give him the treasure? The president must have a brain hemorrhage."
"I've never felt so helpless in my life," Julia said, furious.
Suddenly, unpredictably, Pitt's lips spread in a crazy grin. "I wouldn't take it too badly if I were you. There's always a bright side." She stared at him as if he was certifiably insane.
"What are you talking about? Where do you see a bright side in allowing that scum to roam free and steal the art masterpieces for himself?"
"The orders from the White House definitely state that the INS is not to molest or harass Chin Chang."
"So?"
"The orders," Pitt said, still grinning, but with a hard edge to his voice, "make no mention of what Numa can or cannot do." He broke off as Gunn ran excitedly from the control room onto the bridge wing.
"Al thinks he's got them," the words rushed out. "He's coming to the surface now and wants to know how you want them handled."
"Very carefully," said Pitt. "Tell him to rise slowly and maintain a good grip. When he surfaces, we'll lift the Sappho 4 aboard with them."
"Who is them?" asked Julia.
Pitt gave her a quick glance before he rushed down a ladder to the submersible recovery deck. "The bones of Peking Man, that's who." Word quickly spread throughout the salvage fleet, and the Ocean Retriever's crew began assembling on the stern work deck. The crews of the other vessels crowded their railings, watching the activity aboard the Numa ship. There was a strange silence as the turquoise Sappho 4 broke the surface and rolled slightly from the low waves of the lake. Divers waited in the water to attach the crane's cable hook to the lifting ring on top of the submersible. Every eye was on the large wire-mesh basket between the twin articulated arms. Two wooden boxes sat in the basket. They all held their breath as the submersible was slowly lifted from the lake. The crane operator used great caution in swinging the underwater craft over the stern before lowering it gently into its cradle. The crowd on deck gathered around the sub as the ship's archaeologist directed the unloading of the crates on the deck. While the archaeologist, a blonde lady in her 40s by the name of Pat O'Connell, was engaged in exposing the interior of the crates, Giordino threw back the hatch from inside the submersible and pushed his head and shoulders into the open air.
"Where did you find them?" Pitt shouted up at him. "Using a diagram of the deck plans, I managed to force entry into the captain's cabin."
"The location sounds right," said Gunn, peering through his eyeglasses. With the help of four eager pairs of hands, archaeologist O'Connell pried off the top of the crate and peered inside.
"Oh my, oh me, oh my," she muttered in awe.
"What is it?" Pitt demanded. "What do you see?"
"Military footlockers with USMC stenciled on the top."
"Well, don't stand there. Open it up."
"It really should be opened in a laboratory," O'Connell protested. "Proper methodology, you know."
"No," Pitt said flatly. "Proper methodology be damned. These people worked long and hard, and by God they deserve to see the fruits of their labor. Open the footlocker." Seeing that Pitt was not to be denied, and glancing at the sea of faces around her reflecting expressions of hostility, O'Connell knelt down and began working open the latch on the front of the footlocker with a small crowbar. The wall around the latch quickly fell away as if it were made of clay, and she lifted the lid open very, very slowly.
Inside the footlocker, the upper tray held several objects neatly wrapped in sodden gauze and exactingly placed in little individual compartments. As if she was unwrapping the Holy Grail, O'Connell delicately removed the covering from the largest object. When the last piece of gauze fell away, she held up what looked like a yellow-brown circular bowl.
"A skullcap," she said in a hushed voice. "From Peking Man."